Chapter 4. Consolidation and Fragmentation. Ever since Pakistan was created, the pendulum for governing the country has swung between democracy and military rule on the one hand, and secular state and religious state on the other. Was it a case of insufficient imagination, or was it just unrealistic? For the democratically elected rulers, it has always been a case of holding on to power, given that the army has played and continues to play a crucial role behind the scenes. The consequence has been a weakening and erosion of institutional structures, party politics, and the public sphere, and conversely, strengthening of the army. As is often said, nations have armies, but the Pakistani army has a nation. The strength of the army has been further consolidated by a civil bureaucracy of client-patron networks. Taken together, the army-bureaucracy nexus forms the cornerstone of Pakistan as an Islamic nation-state. Some of this, such as the civil and military officialdom, is furniture inherited from the former colonial power. Other aspects, such as the spreading tentacles of religious organizations, patronized and promoted, have grown in the post-colonial milieu. The generals as saviors. In early 1949, Prime Minister Liaquat Ali Khan put forward the objectives resolution for Pakistan's new constitution, in which sovereignty, first and foremost, lay with Allah. A rather stunning about-turn from Jinnah's quoted words of mid-August 1947. 7 years and four prime ministers later, the first constitution was proclaimed in March 1956 and cemented Pakistan's transformation from Jinnah's undefined but secular vision to an Islamic republic. The passage of this time had less to do with drafting the clauses, many of which, as in neighbouring India, were borrowed from the Government of India Act 1935. It owed much more to the persisting political instability, especially since Liaquat was assassinated in October 1951. By October 1958, the government was taken over by a military coup, ushering in the first of four military dictators. In all, between them, the four generals turned presidents, Ayub Khan, 1958-1969, Yahya Khan, 1969-1971, Zia ul Haq, 1977-1988, and Pervez Musharraf, 1999-2008, ruled Pakistan for almost 35 years, that is, half of its existence. Even when not in power, the military has certainly controlled the strings in the background, never more so than in this last democratic decade, 2008 onwards. These years of rule by technocrats, bureaucrats and generals have all left an imprint on Pakistan, shaping and manipulating its identity to ensure that power and wealth remain concentrated in their hands. Another key feature is that whether it is Cold War politics, Islamization in the Zia period, or the War on Terror under Musharraf's regime, all served to ultimately strengthen the military establishment, and all have been endorsed by considerable US financial support. Indeed, when in the late 1970s, the Jimmy Carter administration offered $400 million in assistance to Pakistan, Zia famously rejected this, calling the amount peanuts, and in the next decade, helped funnel the Ronald Reagan administration's billion-plus dollars to the Afghan Mujahids, religious warriors. Following the War on Terror, aid to Pakistan increased 11-fold to $2 billion in 2002, and the country became the third-largest recipient of U.S. military training and assistance during the Bush-Obama era. U.S. aid to Pakistan has dramatically declined since the election of President Trump. In 2013, for the first time, Pakistan transitioned formally from one elected government to another, breaking the pattern of alternating between elections and coups. Underneath this chronic instability was the fragmentation of the All India Muslim League as it sought to reinvent itself as the Pakistan Muslim League in 1947. The party struggled to transition from being the torchbearer of a movement to becoming the party of a government in a regionalized, plural political setup. Organizationally weak, since its establishment by an elite in 1906, it was a party of landlords, aristocrats, businessmen, and intelligentsia, but scarcely that of the peasant, the artisan, the trader, the worker, or the soldier. Its strong showing in Muslim constituencies in 1945 to 1946 elections, in a limited franchise, counted for little in the post-1947 consolidation of the public sphere in Punjab, Bengal, Sindh, NWFP, and Balochistan, provinces where it had been a latecomer. This, in turn, showed up its fragility and insecurity as it sought to adapt to the power sharing that was required in order to stabilize the partitioned provinces. The rot began at the top, where an ailing and old Jinnah assumed, unwisely perhaps, the unelected role of Governor-General and President of the First Constituent Assembly. In doing so, he usurped the place of the elected role with a ceremonial role. In any case, the Qaid-e-Azam died in September 1948, within 13 months of Pakistan's formation, while his longtime deputy, Liaquat, was assassinated in public 3 years later. Thus, with the two founding fathers lost in its formative years, high politics in Pakistan resulted in what the historian Ian Talbot calls a game of musical chairs at the top, played between the civil bureaucracy, military officials, and professional politicians, against a backdrop of the developing Cold War and its pact politics in the early 1950s. Anxiety and lack of faith in democratic institutions was visible almost from the beginning. Jinnah had dismissed the chief minister of NWFP, Khan Abdul Jabbar Khan, popularly known as Dr. Khan Sahib. He was the elder brother of Khan Abdul Ghaffar Khan, famous as Frontier Gandhi, for his non-violent leadership of the anti-colonial resistance movement Khudai Hitmatgars. Also known as Sirkh Posh, or the Red Shirts, they were a social reform organization that gradually turned to politics and, in coalition with the Congress, formed a ministry in NWFP in 1937 and 1946. They were staunchly against the partition plan, which the Congress accepted without consulting them, thus betraying the long-term association with the Khan brothers. The referendum in July 1947 in NWFP was supposed to end the anomaly of a Muslim-majority province with a Congress government and provide the people with a say on whether they should join Pakistan. They voted in favour of Pakistan overwhelmingly, but it was boycotted by the Khudai Hitmatgar members. They were branded traitors and Indian sympathisers and punished by successive governments in Pakistan. Theirs was a poignant consequence of the peculiarity of partitioning a complex public sphere along a single axis, that of religion. Jinnah and the Muslim League showed an early intolerance for the Khan brothers, and especially Ghaffar Khan, whose especial fraternal association with the Congress marked his anachronistic unsuitability for the emerging state narrative in Pakistan. He was imprisoned, his individuality and legacy ignored and erased from history books, and generations of Pakistanis have now grown up without any knowledge of that legendary figure and his anti-colonial movement in NWFP. Ghaffar Khan was cursed with a long life and only died in 1988. 40 years after Jinnah and Gandhi. His brother, Dr. Khan Sahib, was not the only provincial premier dismissed by Jinnah, though. The chief minister of Sindh, Muhammad Ayub Khuro, was shown the door in April 1948. Khuro had been concerned that the exodus of Hindu minorities from Sindh, complemented by the incoming muhajirs, or refugees, from different parts of India, would dilute the local Sindhi cultural identity. The reason for Khuro's departure was his alleged corruption and misconduct, but in the case of Punjab's chief minister, Iftikhar Hussain Khan of Mandot, there was nothing alleged about his unbelievably corrupt regime, which ended in January 1949, when he chose to resign rather than face proceedings for his self-serving handling of the refugee rehabilitation and resettlement plans. Collectively, these acts showed the thin emerging national layer overarching these regional spaces and undermined the fledgling politicians and fragile democratic structures. Instead, they strengthened the military, the bureaucracy and technocracy, and the religious establishment. Successive military dictators have depicted the politicians as capricious, corrupt, and motivated by self-interest, while projecting themselves as saviours of the nation. The ease of their success confirms the grain of genuineness in the charge, but that often came with setting the country's constitutional clock back to colonial-era laws and their preference for strong and centralised power levers. In the 6 years from the assassination of Liaquat, Pakistan saw 6 prime ministers, and by the summer of 1958, Defence Secretary-turned-President Iskander Mirza and his successor, General Ayub Khan, had separately telegraphed their intentions towards and preferences for a dictatorship to the American ambassador, then, as until recently, Pakistan's most valuable diplomatic relationship. While the general at the top functioned as a suitable public face, underneath, a strong military establishment emerged, which spread its tentacles into numerous areas and key components of the economy. The Fauji Foundation was established in 1954 to provide employment and welfare benefits to ex-military personnel. Today, its cradle-to-grave character is clear from its involvement in items as disparate as cereals, gas, cement, oil, meats, fertilizer, and wind energy, to name a few. The Askari Bank, established in 1991, the Army Welfare Trust, established in 1971, the Evacuee Trust Property Board, established in 1960, and the Defence Housing Authority, operating in the major cities and often located in the wealthiest parts, all feed into a wider economy of the military-industrial complex. Aisha Sadiqa's Military Inc., 2007, provides an in-depth analysis of an elaborate system by which the military and its secret services operate and control vast swathes of Pakistan's economy. The military institution is intuitively invested in sustaining and maintaining itself by keeping an external threat, which is often India, alive, and which Aisha Jalal termed the political economy of defence. Cosmopolitan Karachi. Although the majority of the partition-related disturbances, murders, and migration in 1947 to 1948 happened in Punjab, and a little later in 1949 to 1950, and beyond, for Bengal, the magnet for Muslim migrants from North India was Pakistan's first capital, Karachi. The quiet 18th-century pier and the quaint 19th-century metropolis, located on international seaways and airways, now underwent a total transformation. This one-time fishing village at the mouth of the Indus had come into prominence following the annexation of Sindh by the British East India Company in 1843. By the time Jinnah was born there in 1876, Karachi was a thriving commercial cosmopolitan port city, boasting one of the first tramway systems in South Asia. Opened by 1885, it only stopped operating in 1975. The two world wars saw the city's strategic value soar. By now, it was the capital of the youngest British Indian province of Sindh, and its local levers of political power and economic affluence were in the hands of Sindhi Hindus, even though as a whole its demography was majority Muslim. Above all, it nursed and cherished a Sindhi regional and linguistic identity that equally resisted Punjab's dominance in emerging Pakistan, as well as resented the incoming Muhajirs. These millions of refugees who had made the ideological and existential journey of mind and body were received with a sullen ambivalence at best, and open hostility at worst, neither commensurate with their sacrifice nor with the expectations set in motion by the Pakistan movement. A considerable and sensitive strand in the partition literature shows the tragic refugee sacrifice, Muhajir Kabani, in Karachi and across Sindh. The entitlements felt by one group, North Indian Muslims, clashed with the expectations of another, local Sindhi Muslims. While the former had been at the forefront of the Pakistan movement from the beginning, the latter had shored up its spine in the end. Whose was the greater sacrifice for a homeland? Surely those who ultimately left, or were driven away from their ancestral homes, and flocked to this new Medina. Arrival was not easily followed by assimilation, and over the years, the local political conflict of Karachi coalesced around the Muhajir fault line, as their demographic impact was substantial. In 1941, the population of Karachi had been 435,000. 10 years later, the numbers had soared to over 1 million, of which the Muhajirs comprised 55%, thereby making the local Sindhis a minority. Ultimately, in the 20 years between 1941 and 1961, Karachi's population grew by an astounding 432%, a staggering rate of growth which, as the geographer Oscar Speight exclaims, no other city anywhere else in the world at any time in human history has ever experienced. The fallout of this astounding growth was a heightened sense of regionalism in the 1950s, a decline in national politics in the 1960s, and labour unrest in the 1970s. By then, the Muhajirs had also organised with the establishment of the All Pakistan Muhajir Student Organisation, founded in 1978. It was the precursor to the Muhajir Kwami Movement, renamed Mutahida Kwami Movement, MQM, in 1984, which was founded by Altaf Hussain to protect the rights of Muhajirs from a quota system that would reduce their access to opportunities, and argued that the Muhajirs constituted the fifth ethnic group in Pakistan. The MQM dominated the political landscape in Karachi from 1988, thanks to the successful mobilization of ethnic nationalism and militancy. This prompted the government of Pakistan in 1992 to send the military to Karachi to cleanse the city of anti-social elements, namely the MQM. Hussein fled to the UK, where he sought and received political asylum, but he continued with his political ambitions despite being implicated in the murder of a senior party member, Imran Farooq, in 2010. In August 2016, speaking from his North London base, Hussein lambasted Pakistan as a cancer for the entire world and the epicentre of terrorism. This call to incite his supporters into action led to horrific violence in Karachi, and despite the apology by Hussein a few days later, Farooq Sattar broke rank and the party split in 2017, with MQMP operating from Pakistan and Hussein controlling the MQM London party. The MQM's political growth coincided with and contributed to a period of immense political instability and violence in the city of Karachi. The late 1980s and especially the 1990s reduced Karachi to one of the most dangerous cities in the world, whose ordered disorder only began to stabilise following the military crackdown in 2013. Through these decades, it served as a destination for refugees fleeing the wars in Afghanistan and was flooded by the flotsam and jetsam of American weaponry meant for the Mujahideens in Afghanistan. The wider, longer-term consequences of this were a society saturated with firearms and embroiled in drug trafficking and extortionist activities, real estate mafias, and politics by violence, giving rise to the term Kalashnikov culture. In 2016, Amjad Sabri, a popular Khawali, Sufi devotional song singer, was shot dead in Karachi. He was targeted as a consequence of being caught up in the widespread violence, political and general, that has cursed the city. While the murder was widely condemned, it highlighted how deep the rot had penetrated. For Karachi to become the dual capital of Pakistan and the province of Sindh was not inevitable. Multan was in the running because it was located in the heart of Pakistan and, as seen previously, was an established, holier and more historic city. There was some support for Dhaka in East Pakistan, but it had been peripheral in the Pakistan movement, and although a strong contender, Lahore was unfortunately badly affected by the chaos and violence following partition. Also, it was too close to the newly created border with India. Karachi, on the other hand, was relatively far away and calm. It offered opportunities to be connected to the outside world via sea and air, and had an existing infrastructure which could be expanded. Thus, Jinnah and Liaquat Ali Khan leapt at the chance of turning Karachi into the capital of the new nation when the Sindh Muslim League offered. In turn, Hyderabad now became the regional capital of Sindh. This arrangement proved short-lived, and by 1959, Ayub Khan had announced that the capital would be shifted to the garrison city of Rawalpindi, while a twin city would be built nearby. It was a bold and dramatic move, and while Ayub found the tropical climate of Karachi unfavourable, moving the capital to the more sedate climate of the Margalla Hills also allowed the military general headquarters, GHQ, to converge and converse closely with the new political capital, Islamabad. This city of Islam was designed by the Greek architect C.A. Doxiadis and funded by international organizations such as the Ford Foundation in America. It was a purpose-built, planned city that encapsulated the era of Khan's modernist vision for Pakistan, which was to be realized under the watchful eyes of the nearby military GHQ. This shift also finalized the break with the declining old guard of the pre-1947 Muslim League politics and crowned the domination of Punjabis and Pashtuns in the new political bureaucratic military nexus. Modern Karachi is politically peripheral, but remains at the core of commerce, trade, and cultural activities, a cosmopolitan melting pot of hope and aspiration for many who continue to flock to this great metropolis on the shores of the Arabian Sea. Bangladesh breaks away. Although Pakistan was imagined as a homeland for the Muslims of India, it was never a wholly Muslim country, nor did it encompass all Indian Muslims. Its 1951 census had yielded a combined population of 76 million, of which the majority, 42 million, lived in East Pakistan, Bengal. Almost 23% of this population were Bengali Hindus, while by contrast, West Pakistan only had a minority population of 3%. Although a greater number of Hindus initially remained in the eastern wing, by 1950 to 1951, it became clear that the upper and middle class Hindu Bhadralok, genteel, preferred to migrate to India. This, in turn, created openings in the administrative services for educated Muslims in eastern India who were attracted to Dhaka, the new old capital of East Pakistan. Back in 1905, the division of British India's Bengal province had set a precedent for Dhaka's elevation as the provincial capital of the eastern part, a status which it soon lost when this partition was annulled in 1911. Now, in the early 1950s, although sharing the same faith, the two wings of Pakistan were unable to bridge the physical and the otherwise quite distinct linguistic, ethnic, cultural, climatic, and historical differences. From the beginning, then, Pakistan was faced with the challenges of first trying to keep two physically separate wings connected, and second, trying to construct a national Muslim identity from a population that was otherwise fragmented along linguistic, cultural, ethnic, and economic lines. United Provinces Urdu-speaking elite, who had come to have close ties with the political establishment in Karachi upon their migration, and shared its attachment to a one-nation, one-culture, one-language policy, propelled the Constituent Assembly's rejection of Bangla or Bengali as a state language and its refusal to hold sessions in Dhaka. This was the trigger for Bengali alienation from Pakistan, which grew through the 1950s and to which other grievances, principally economic, became added. It would test the limits of the two-nation theory to its core, as the question persisted, was Islam sufficient to keep the two wings together? In March 1948, against the backdrop of rising agitation against this imposition of Urdu, Jinnah made his first and last trip to the eastern side of the country. Addressing an audience of 500,000 people at the Ramna Racecourse Maidan, Dhaka, he acknowledged the importance of East Bengal and how efforts were being made to ensure that East Pakistan attains its full stature with the maximum speed. He claimed that Pakistan overall had done much to ensure that minorities were protected during these difficult times, despite evidence to the contrary. His speech reflected the early anxiety and insecurity felt by the fragile state, with references to enemies of the state, subversive elements, communists, and fifth columnists, all conspiring to divide and destroy this new homeland. But above all, to the crowd's disbelief, the speech, delivered in English and addressed to a Bengali audience, reaffirmed Urdu as the state language. Urdu, of course, was not just a lingua franca. It was symbolically and ideologically attached to the Pakistan movement. For a singular national identity to emerge, the political leadership felt that there should be one national language, but the reality on the ground was that this flowery language of poetry and pathos, written in flowing Persian calligraphy, was only spoken by the small elite from the United Provinces, now the ruling class and based in Karachi, who had imagined and articulated this project. The protests were swift. Civic unrest escalated, and by 1952, the Urdu-Bengali controversy was at boiling point, despite the assent of a Bengali governor-general, Khawaja Nazimuddin, for the whole of Pakistan as Jinnah's successor. Nazimuddin, despite being Bengali, inflamed the language debate by defending the Urdu-only policy. Maulana Boshani, co-founder of the Muslim Awami League, established in 1949, warned the West Pakistani leadership against the imposition of Urdu and was already demanding independence. The unlawful assembly of demonstrators under Section 144, centered around the University of Dhaka, ended in confrontations with the police on the 21st of February 1952. Over the next few days, the demonstrators grew to thousands, with the authorities using tear gas and firing to suppress the young student protesters. Officially, 5 martyrs are commemorated on this day. Unofficially, the numbers were most likely higher. The government blamed Hindus, communists, and others plotting against the state, rather than rectifying the genuine grievances. Since the year 2000, in recognition of these events, the 21st of February is observed by the United Nations as the International Mother Language Day to highlight and celebrate linguistic diversity. The intensity of these language riots showed up the interregional and intra-communal fault line in Pakistan's early demographic composition. It dwarfed in symbolism and long-term significance the Liaquat-Nehru Pact of 1950, signed between India and Pakistan, with a mutually reinforcing aim to protect the rights of religious minorities in their midst. It reflected the genuine concerns that the Bengalis, Hindus and Muslims, harboured about becoming the inferior other in Pakistan, starting with losing state recognition and patronage of their proud regional vernacular, captured by prolific writers such as Shamsur Rahman and Qazi Nazrul Islam, who became the national poet of Bangladesh. In 1954, The One Unit program was launched by PM Muhammad Ali Bogra, becoming implemented by PM Chowdhury Muhammad Ali on the 14th of October 1955. The program significantly sought to merge the four provinces of the Western Wing to outmatch East Pakistan for administrative purposes. In 1954, elections took place in East Pakistan, in which the Muslim League was defeated at the hands of the United Front, led by the former Prime Minister of Bengal, A.K. Fazlul Huq's Krishak Shramrik Party, Farmer Labour Party, and Maulana Bashani's Awami League. It would turn out to be a turbulent year in the trajectory of United Pakistan, with industrial unrest and labour riots in the east, blamed upon enemy agents by the West-based central government, which imposed direct rule. This authoritarian attitude of Karachi towards Dhaka set the template for future transactions until the unmaking of this United Pakistan 15 years later. With the creation of the One Unit to counter East Pakistan, issues of domination and representation only became starker, even as, in 1956, Karachi relented and gave Bengali official recognition. By then, the physical separation and emotional distance between the two wings were becoming worse through growing economic disparity, which would culminate in a conflict over state sovereignty and the very meaning of nationhood. Soon, insult was to be added to this injury by Ayub Khan and his military ilk, who were quasi-racist in their scathing dismissal of the East Bengalis, formerly under subjugation until Pakistan was created, and regarded as still under the influence of an effeminate Hindu culture and language, hence their reluctance to embrace a more martial Islamic identity, as evident in the Western Wing. The arrogance and prejudice, disdain and discrimination for the Eastern Province was not just visible in the racialized language used, but was starkly apparent in who was controlling the purse strings and the narrative around national identity. For many, East Pakistan was merely a colony. The Western Province dominated the political, bureaucratic, and military class, while much of the economy in the early days was heavily dependent on the jute exports from the eastern side. One of the largest jute processing factories in the world was located in the suburbs of Dhaka, but was owned by the Adamji family in the Western Wing. Insofar as investment, infrastructure, and welfare went, there was a stark indifference to East Pakistan, neglect, and what amounted almost to neo-colonialism. Between 1950 and 1970, the ratio of government spending between West and East wings was estimated to be 70-30. In 1966, the Bengali politicians put together a six-point program seeking a federal constitution, convertible currencies, power to tax and spend, separate foreign exchange reserve, and separate paramilitary forces, especially navy, given the long coastline in the east. Drafted, amongst others, by Rehman Saban and Nurul Islam, the proposal for greater provincial autonomy was rejected by politicians in West Pakistan and those not aligned to the Awami League. The disparity between the two wings was evident in the military administrator's response when the deadly Bhola cyclone ravaged the southern districts of East Pakistan on the 12th of November 1970, killing an estimated 300,000 to 500,000 people. The failure to respond with immediacy, declaring a national emergency, and the lack of adequate relief only confirmed the wider feelings of neglect and exploitation felt in the Eastern Wing. Under the clouds of growing instability, following transition from one military dictator to another, the first national elections took place in December 1970. They were scheduled to take place on the 5th of October, but were postponed due to floods. The results showed a resounding victory for the East Pakistan-based Awami League and its leader, Sheikh Mujibur Rahman. The party fought on the 6 points program and won 160 out of the 300 seats, representing 39% of the popular vote. However, the West Pakistan-based Pakistan People's Party, led by Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, which won 81 seats, refused to recognize these results. The incumbent regime of General Yahya Khan attempted to foster an agreement between the two parties, even as the situation on the ground was deteriorating towards a civil war. Attempting to protect the army as the savior once again, Operation Searchlight began from March 1971 under the pretext of checking outbreaks of anti-Bihari violence by East Bengalis. Over the summer of 1971, the Pakistan Army systematically targeted pro-independence supporters in Dhaka and the Bengal countryside, killing a generation of students, academics, workers, committing mass rapes against women, atrocities against minorities, and leaving deep scars across a region and soon to be a nation. Typically, there can be little agreement on how many died, with the Bangladeshis putting this figure at 3 million. As ever, the real brunt of the brutality unleashed that year, told through women's testimonies, the silent sufferers in this human tragedy, is being narrated only now, the 50th year of Bangladesh's birth. By the monsoon autumn of 1971, approximately 9 million refugees had fled across the border into India, and, with consequent Indian intervention, the year ended in the Third India-Pakistan War that culminated in the creation of Bangladesh in December 1971. As the political commentator Tariq Ali remarks, the two-nation theory formulated in the middle-class living rooms of Uttar Pradesh was buried in the Bengali countryside. The bloody stains of this spectral wound and brutal genocide have left an indelible mark on the subcontinent, and Bangladesh was in many ways the definitive, unfinished business of partition. It would take until February 1974 for the 90,000 Pakistani prisoners of war to return home and Pakistan to give diplomatic recognition to Bangladesh. This came on an occasion which portended the Islamic turn that the country would take, as PM Bhutto received and feted Sheikh Mujib, along with 36 other heads of state from among the major Muslim nations of the world in Lahore that month. Addressing a packed Lahore television studio, a visibly emotional Bhutto declared in Urdu, "In the name of Allah and on behalf of the peoples of this country, I declare that we are recognizing Bangladesh." In retrospect, perhaps it was inconceivable that two such disparate provinces could exist as one country, despite the technological advances made in the 20th century, without a true spirit of accommodation and power-sharing. From that viewpoint, it is in fact remarkable that they managed to do so for almost 25 years. Although Pakistan began from an institutionally weak position, it was this breakup of the two wings that led formerly West Pakistan towards a path not envisioned by the Qaid-e-Azim. Pakistan now entered a new Islamic phase of its history, armed with another constitution, 1973, to meet another existential crisis. Rather than embrace and celebrate diversity under the elected Bhutto and the dictator General Zia-ul-Haq, the regime once again opted for the opposite. Its aim now was for a totally homogeneous Islamic identity around its majority Sunni faith, Persianized Urdu, and Arabified idioms.